I'm your daddy.
I can be smart when it's important.
I'm your daddy.
I'm sorry to disappoint.
I'm your daddy.
Welcome to Daddy Dailies, a podcast hosted by Not Your Daddy's Films. On a film set, dailies are sent out after a shoot day so you can see the work in progress. Daddy Dailies are conversations that go behind the scenes so you can see what work went into the process and be better armed to succeed in the industry.
Daddy Dailies, hosted by Not Your Daddy's Films.
Hi, Daddy Dailies listeners. This is Vika. I'm hopping on to let you know that there's about 4 minutes of audio in this episode where our mics in the studio simply cut out. Technical glitches happen, but luckily we were able to extract our in-camera audio and use it for that tiny section. But we wanted you to know that if you're listening and you hear that, it's right at the beginning. It does get better, and we hope you really enjoy the episode and interview with Claudia Restrepo.
Welcome back to Daddy Dailies. I'm Vika Settlebine. I'm one of the co-founders of Not Your Daddy's Films.
Full disclosure, our guest today is one of my best friends in life, and I'm so excited she agreed to come on the podcast to talk about her approach to art and the industry and the way that those two things can sometimes feel like they are in direct conflict with one another. She is a writer, a director, a producer, an actor, an editor. There's truly nothing she can't do. After attending Occidental College and working with some of the biggest digital creators on the internet, Claudia had a successful career at BuzzFeed, where she was a creator for the Paralike team, among many other things there. Claudia then went on to act in shows like Vita on Stars, and she wrote on The Book of Queer, an Emmy Award-winning series for Discovery Plus. In 2021, she was a producer for the South by Southwest feature The End of Us, and then worked with a lot of the same team on 2023's Peak Season, which also was at South by Southwest, and she also stars in it.
Claudia Restrepo, welcome to Daddy Dailies.
Hi. I have to throw it back to our host and say I feel honored to be here with one of my best friends.
Yeah.
Also an amazing filmmaker. And it's just been so fun. We've known each other so long now. It feels like we've really grown in this industry together.
Claudia and I met because we both moved in with our mutual friend. And I very much was like, this girl's gonna be my friend. And knocked on her door with a bottle of wine. And I think I like forced you to tell me your life story.
Yeah, which is, I love our origin story because I, at the time, was going through a bad, like, relationship breakup and friend breakup, and was like not in a, you know, was in a very protective space. And I always say I didn't, you know, expect to make a new best friend at that point in my life, and really needed someone with your stubbornness and your just like love and warmth to break through like truly the ice barrier. I had put like, I was Elsa. I had made my frozen ice castle and knocked on the door with a bottle of wine, and we're like,
do you want to make a snowman?
Yeah,
now and the rest is just
really
exciting. You had purple hair at the time.
Oh, yeah, I was really going through it.
And I had never dyed my hair, done anything unique. And I was sort of like, wow, this person is so cool. She has tattoos. Like, I don't know.
That was just the BuzzFeed starter package when you were like in your mid-20s and making digital content. You went there, you got a tattoo, you dyed your hair, you came out as bi. Like, that was just what you did.
You grew up in the Midwest in St. Louis. Was it like, I want to work in entertainment always, or like what kind of inspired you to pursue this career path and brought you out to LA?
No, I always wanted to write, and I was always involved with like theater and music. It was just like from a very young age, I was sort of like, and this happens when you're a kid, you know, people just praise you for what you're kind of inherently good at. And then it's sort of hard to separate your identity from that. You're like, have I always wanted to be an artist, or was I just told that I was good at these certain things? But I did truly love them and enjoy them. So like I always was involved in theater and like writing for the school plays and then acting in them and, you know, doing directing classes with it. So when I went to college, though, I thought I would do more like take more of like an academic route with English literature. I really enjoyed that. And I got seduced by the theater again in college. I can't stay away, and double majored in like theater and English lit. And after that, continued to pursue like writing. And it was never on my radar to do TV writing. It wasn't until after college that I was kind of struggling as an actress and was like, why am I abandoning like this notion I'd had of writing? Like, I'm in a city where you can do that. You can take your love of playwriting and hopefully make a career for yourself in, you know, TV and film.
Yeah.
But truly growing up, it was just like just, you know, growing up in St. Louis, Missouri, it's just worlds away.
Yeah.
You don't even know what that looks like or that it's a career path.
Do you remember what your first, like, play that you wrote for elementary or high school was about?
I do remember having to write a scene to audition to get to write for in the middle
school. Oh, cutthroat.
Yes. I went to a very good public school system. You had to send in a script to, like, apply to, they would make a play every
year. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they were varying levels of awful.
No, that's cool though. We just did, like, Year in Town and High School Musical.
I think it's so great for kids. That's a whole other tangent. It's just like how wonderful I think middle school and high school theater can be for people. And
especially at that time in your life.
Yeah. And I loved that they made their own musicals. I thought that was so fun to involve everybody at every stage of it. And I had to apply with a scene. I just remember writing a scene about a kid that gets lost at a baseball game. I don't even remember what happens, but I remember writing and being like, this is really good. I'm definitely going to get to write for the play. And then I did. And I wish I carried that confidence with me today.
I similarly feel like I had that confidence in elementary and middle and high school because it was such a small town. Mm-hmm. The naivete was really awesome.
I know. Yeah. I really wish we could bottle that.
Yeah.
Because you have to be that way. Mm-hmm. Like, you just have to. And the older we get, we lose so much of that. And they're so much more, like, careful about things.
Yeah. So you said you struggled as an actor, which I'm sure didn't super help your confidence. So you decided to sort of, like, refocus at that time? Were you at BuzzFeed already, or were you?
No. So I got out of college and was very naive, I think, to, like, what it takes to be an actor in LA. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many conservatories or schools, like, truly do prepare you. There's very few that, like, prepare you for the actual business of acting. And as much as I'm like, I think it was hard to be, like, a young Latina actress. You were absolutely almost always only going out for Latina roles, or Ethnically Ambiguous was very popular at
very
that time.
Very popular.
And I was like, I can play Italian. I can play Greek. Like, I, you know, would have played roles that would have absolutely gotten me canceled today if they'd given them to me then, because I would have been 22 and would have been like, yes, pay me. I'll play whatever you want me to.
Yeah.
So I'm almost grateful I wasn't more cast, because I would have some very embarrassing things on my IMDb page. So even though I'm saying, yes, it was hard then, I also think I didn't meet acting with, like, truly the dedication and, like, the business mindset that it takes, I think, to succeed in it. And you can have that mindset and still not succeed. But I think it was a bit of a two-hander where I was like, wow, this is so much harder than I realized. Mm-hmm. You have to hustle and network and take classes to a degree that, like, I was unprepared for, and also was just didn't feel like could see how small I think, like, the opportunity pool was. Yeah. So I was like, oh, I can absolutely kill myself and pay for these things I don't have money for to get, like, you know, a walk-on role as, like, the Latina girlfriend in a show and never have more lines. So I pivoted pretty quickly. I was just like, this ain't it, to writing and, you know, sort of trying to do web series and, mm-hmm. and create my own work and do a Fringe Fest play.
Give yourself more lines.
Just give myself more lines and make more work. And then that did lead to applying to, like, you know, writing programs. Early on, I did the National Hispanic Media Coalition has a great writing program for, like, really early writers that are just trying to get their feet wet and, like, learn, you know, how to write pilots better and, like, get introductions. And that was an amazing program. I sort of had, like, a big life change around 25, 26. I was like, this is not going the way I'd planned. Like, I have met zero success. I have to make a change. And around then started, you know, applying to the programs and and really trying to push the body of work that I'd had up until that point towards a real job and, like, career. And that did lead to the BuzzFeed internship that really changed the trajectory of me as a content creator and, like, filmmaker.
I totally relate to what you're saying. The idea that you don't know how hard it's going to be when you come out of school and you don't know, like, how to create those opportunities for yourself necessarily. But I always very much related to you, even before we became such close friends, how much you created these opportunities for yourself, for other people. And it's always had such a stamp of your point of view on it. So when you got to BuzzFeed, Was it sort of like grad school? Because it seems to me from an outside perspective, like they teach you how to edit and how to produce for like no money. Did you already have your like voice, you think, when you came in?
That's a great question. I think I did in the sense that like I knew I liked comedies and was in a sort of like very like rebellious stage in my life then where it's almost not the type of work I would want to make now, but at the time I was like, I want to make like comedies that like say things about like women and I think in a very, I don't know, like an ambitious way, you know, like when you have things to say before you know how to be able to say them. Mm-hmm. So I think I knew the type of things I wanted to make. And then once I learned a little bit more about filmmaking or tools, the content I wanted to make and like my point of view also changed just because I was like aging with it. But I came in after having made, some like really fun web series, wanting to do comedy. I joined BuzzFeed under the guise of thinking that they would have a very strong scripted program. So I joined. Oh. I joined because I had come out of NHMC, this like writing program. I had applied to all these studio programs. I was like, I want to write for TV. This is how you do it. You apply to these programs. You know, you get an internship. You work as a PA. You get a job. All these things. This internship opportunity came at like a networking event. A recruiter from BuzzFeed came to speak with us. And they were really saying this is the future of television is online. It's going to streaming. You know, we're really dedicated to building up our scripted department at BuzzFeed. That's why we're here talking to you, potential writers. You know, Orange is the New Black was like huge on Netflix. Yeah. House of Cards was coming. It was just like
that Netflix boom. Everything. Of those prestige shows.
And everything, you know, they're saying like network is dead. This is the way to go.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, of course, I'm going to apply to that, too. That just feels like another bet. And then when I got the internship, the way the program was created, we were sort of just learning how to make internet videos, like very early on. You sometimes got to do things that were scripted, but there was a whole nother actual scripted department sort of behind a wall, like literally in the building. They were like hidden in like a cavern. So they felt very far away. But I was like, oh, if I stick out my time here, I'll get to that scripted room eventually.
Yeah.
I ended up staying with the company for many, many years, and their scripted program got smaller and smaller until it was basically non-existent. But you got to create a lot of narrative work while working there. It just, the model didn't make sense in streaming for them to be creating longer form scripted shows. And they, you know, they tried to sell them like a lot of these different media companies did. They had things with YouTube Red. They had things with Go90,
like platforms. Some of them, of course, still exist, but like Go90 made a lot of stuff with Awesomeness. And do either of those exist anymore?
Awesomeness, I believe, yes, does.
But
they're not creating these short digital shows.
Yeah, exactly. But one of our mutual friends had one of her first like series regular roles on a Go90 show, and that's how I learned about it. And they were all like shorter TV shows. Like the episodes were all like longer than 10 minutes, but shorter than like a traditional on your television episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then you made the web series before BuzzFeed. So you'd been on a set before, and you had acted, directed, written on those.
Sort of all of it. You know, we did. God, those early days of experimenting with YouTube, you forget everything you've done.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember I did like a like other YouTube clip review show with two of my other friends that you know, Alex and Kaja.
I didn't know that.
Nobody looked this up. It was it was like aimed towards children and was like so much more scripted than it needed to be.
Cute.
It was cute. We made a lot of episodes of it, but things like that, like where you're really experimenting. You're like, I don't know what's gonna hit. Like, I guess we just
And you're making stuff with your friends. And,
so we don't. Yeah. And I had like a web series that we like never released, unfortunately, with like an ex-boyfriend that was about a comedy at a dispensary. And I'd done this like, you know, Fringe Festival play that won some awards. Like, you're really just trying to scrape together a resume.
The Fringe Festival in L.A. is similar to the Fringe Festival in New York or something. Not at the scale of Edinburgh Fringe Festival, if you're familiar with that, but there's all sorts of different kinds of live performance. So traditional plays, one-woman shows, like all sorts of things like that. And this was before I knew, but I remember hearing you'd done this, and it had always been kind of on my bucket list. So what was that like for you?
I loved it. It was great. I don't know if it's any different now. I doubt it is. I think it says it's pretty much the same playbook towards like raising some money, renting a space, getting your friends to do all these things and putting on a play. It was fantastic. Yeah, I think it really built up my confidence as a creator, and you know that it's also just really good to learn to be that collaborative with your friends outside of school.
Yeah.
So it was a really good training ground towards creating more work.
So fast forward to the two features I mentioned when I introduced you, The End of Us and Peak Season. You were a producer on both, and from what I understand, relatively small crews. Can you talk about like working on those? And was there a way that your past experience wearing all the hats led into that?
Yeah, I definitely, I guess maybe it's giving too much credit to like an internet job to be like, I really credit it with like helping me be collaborative, because you're doing that up until then. Like you just said, with the Fringe Fest or anything you're making, you're already learning to wear every hat and like edit and write and and do things. But I do think that job did function as a grad school.
Yeah.
You had access to equipment. You were able to create things without the highest stakes. Like, yes, it was your job and there were stakes inherent to that, but it wasn't like, you know, your only shot at making a film, and it wasn't like $10,000 of your own money
going into
something. So it really was an incredible place to like learn and experiment. And I made so many things there that I like would not have attempted to make and not have realized that I learned something from them.
Yeah.
You know, like I made food videos for years. I made, you know, beauty videos. I made docu things and I learned something from all of them, but I would not have instinctually gone and done those. I would not have been like, I want to make super detailed cinematic videos about a corn chowder. Like never in my life would I. And then I learned something about editing from it.
You know? Totally.
Like, or I learned something about precision and like how to sell something that doesn't feel very dynamic, but sell it with the camera. Like you just learn. I learned so much and met some of, you know, people that are still my collaborators today. So it very much functioned as film school in that way. Some filmmakers that I'd worked very closely with on other projects that they had decided, and this was our co-directors for The End of Us, Henry Lovner and Steven Cantor, who I'd worked with for many years at BuzzFeed, had decided 2020 was their year to make their feature. And they were so excited. And then lockdown happened. And, you know,
and you and I were living together at the time.
We were living together. It was a very interesting,
it was a stressful
time.
But Henry and Steve were kind of in our bubble, too.
Yes. Full transparency, I date Henry Lovner and had, and had dated him for several years by that point.
Yeah.
So they were already part of our bubble.
Yes.
Our COVID bubble, because Steven lived with Henry at the time.
Yeah.
So the pandemic and the lockdown situation created a lot of constraints on any potential filmmaking, much in the way that we were very used to with making things at BuzzFeed, though. For as much as I'm like, wow, we had so much access to things, and we absolutely did, it is not nothing to say, hey, we had access to a cage of equipment.
Oh, yeah, of
course.
That's
huge. However, we were not being handed huge budgets. We were not being told, like, here's $10,000, go make a film, go hire your actors and pay them and do it like that. We were also working on very tight schedules. Most of the time when you shot something, you shot it within a week and like you wrote it, you directed it. Maybe you held the camera, maybe you didn't. Sometimes you did get someone else and then you edited it. And you maybe had a producer checking in on you being like, hey, are you sticking to a budget? Hey, when will this come in?
Yeah.
But not a like on the ground producer. Like you were sourcing things. You were doing a lot of the work. So it translated to having to make a very small micro budget film under the constraints of COVID pretty well.
Yeah.
Like we had all worked together previously on so many projects. We were like, we're just making a longer.
Yeah. Video. And you know how you work together already.
And it demanded working in lockdown and like filming in lockdown demanded an intimacy that like, thankfully we all already had.
Yeah.
And had all, you know, had already like traveled together to work on things. And that film is so small. I mean, we filmed for like 2 weeks in a house in Eagle Rock, you know, took our COVID tests and quarantined. And it was a great experience.
It's a movie about a couple uncoupling, essentially. They lived together during the pandemic and like so many people experienced, they break up and they're still living together.
I hope it's something people will revisit years later when they're ready to revisit COVID stuff and be like, fuck, that was my experience. I broke up during COVID, you know, like so many people that happened to.
Yeah, well, I think that what I love about it, trying to be as objective as possible, because I know a lot of the people involved in this, is that it is set within COVID, but it is not about COVID. Because I think a lot of movies tried to like take advantage of the time and like be about the experience we were all having. And I was just like, I'm already living this. I don't really want to watch a movie about it, or like Contagion vibes, like this virus that we can't control. And this was truly like, yes, it's within that setting and this very familiar feeling of like we're in completely new scary territory, but it's very funny, and it is really it's comes just back a to the
relatable
relationship
breakup yeah. comedy. Yeah,
yeah,
that happens to be set in the yeah
yeah
confines of.
COVID. And then with yeah. Peak Season, you are producing it and directing in it, and you guys went to Wyoming to film. So can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, that was the same group of filmmakers, and Henry and Steven were like, okay, we're we got to do another one. It's yeah. 2 years later, we need to step it up slightly, but you know, it was still going to be a pretty micro budget
yeah.
project. And I knew the script in its early stages because Henry was writing it. And, you know, when you have a creative partner that you live with, you know every
yeah.
stage of it. So I had heard of it when it was just a nugget of an idea and, you know, and read early drafts and was always like, wow, the character of Amy seems like has a lot of similarities to me. Or like, wow, it just seems like Amy would be great for me. But with a creative partner,
right.
Well, with a creative partner, you also don't, it's like so important to me too, that with a partner
yeah.
who casts things and like who is a director that I'm not pushing, like
yeah.
both for my relationship and for just like my own knowledge, you know,
yeah.
with the project in general, did not want to like
push myself on it.
So like, I just read these early drafts and didn't say anything. And
but you really wanted it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I had actually, this makes me sound bad, we'd had a previous feature that also starred me and Derek.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
DeBlasis.
Yeah. Barking, which you can watch on Vimeo.
Right.
It's beautiful black and white short film that is about another couple uncoupling.
I know.
It's very cute.
I love that film. It's so good.
It's very real and sweet, and I liked it a lot.
Yeah. But we had been, Henry and Derek were thinking of developing a feature version of that.
Right.
And basically we're like, well, you know, we level this up, names are very important. So, like, mm-hmm. they were thinking if they should cast someone else. And then because this was, like, maybe, I guess it was still within COVID
mm-hmm.
that they were thinking of working on that. And I really pushed to get to still work in that.
Yeah.
I was like, I think I would still be really good in this role. I don't want to take away any sort of opportunity if you find someone else.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
like, I really want to be part of this. And then that got scrapped. Forget why it fully fell apart. But it was nothing very dramatic. It was just like losing speed on that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So when then this one came up, I was like, this is my chance. I really want to be a part of this. You know, I always say if they'd had the money to afford someone more famous, I would have happily stepped aside.
Yeah.
Because that is a name. If I've learned anything from producing to micro budget features, it's that names are really important.
Names help launch things. Yeah.
It's maybe the most sadly important.
Really?
Oh yeah. In terms of distributing and marketing a film and mm-hmm. getting attention, the most important thing.
Duly noted. I'm going to keep that in the back of my mind for when I make a micro budget yeah. feature.
And you mean that doesn't mean don't cast the person that you know that would be absolutely best. Perfect and like best for it. But even now with films I've seen that did the same festival rounds with us that I think have names,
mm-hmm.
it's still really hard. And
yeah.
that's with someone, you know, recognizable. Like,
yeah, yeah.
So for especially a very like micro budget, if Aubrey Plaza had been like, I really want to do a tiny no name film in Wyoming, I would have been like, you, like, please, you need to cast her. Like, I will happily. I wouldn't have been fighting for that role. And it can definitely happen, and it happens pretty often. I'm, you know, when
yeah.
other directors are, you know, want to cast somebody with a name, I'm like, shoot your shot.
Yeah,
you never know.
They might love the story.
Actors want to act. Like they.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there's something very like freeing and exciting about the immediacy of like an independent film that can move as quickly and be as flexible as it can be when you're used to these giant studio films that like you don't have a say in, or you can't name anybody on the crew. Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
you're spending more time in a trailer than on a set. You know, it it does come with its own difficulties, of course. I think if I were a larger star taking a chance with a crew I don't know, like, you're also opening yourself up to maybe a rough time if it's not well-funded or,
yeah,
you know, there it, there's also that chance for sure. But
yeah,
it can be, I think, probably very fulfilling for an actor who's used to a much more, like, sterile environment to get to hop on an indie film.
Yeah, and there's an excitement in that that I think a lot of artists are attracted to. The opportunity to, like, have this very unique experience. So for Peak Season, because you are in pretty much every frame of that movie, did you find it hard to separate yourself from the producer side and just be in the moment? Or was it easy for you to kind of switch gears?
I think when you're directing and acting, it is very hard.
Yeah.
Because I've done that as well. And in entertaining, you know, notions of a feature that I'd like to make and would like to play a role in, whether that's, you know, larger or smaller, that's a huge consideration, is like, does that serve the project? Like, yeah, will I actually be able to execute the vision I want while also stepping in front of camera? And I think the answer to that is you better have an incredible producer, mm-hmm, like, because that is very hard to do. In terms of this project, I was producing, but not to the capacity that I had on the first film.
Yeah.
And we had another producer who very sweetly before the film was like, Claudia, I want you to focus on the acting.
Oh,
just
good.
Know that, like, let go. Tell me if you need me to, like, support you in some way in that, you know, like, this needs to be your first
That's
job.
That's a good producer.
It was really yeah, nice to sort of hear someone, you know, remind me that that's the priority. It's more that the pre-action work was a little more anxious, if that makes sense, because yeah, I was worried about things that needed to happen for the production and probably wasn't able to, like, focus on just preparing for a scene as mm-hmm much as I'd wanted. But when they called action and you're in a scene, it was easier than I thought to just be like, I'm just here. Like, I'm just in the scene. I don't have time to, like, think about whether that was the right shirt we picked for that actor or, you know, or the set, you know, the camera setups or something. So.
No, 100%. I do want to actually quickly talk about the approach that you took as an actor to the script, because I know that some of the stuff was improvised, and you've come from a theater background where it's like the playwright is king and, like, don't change the words. Did you find it really easy to live in that world and do the script but also add your own touches?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and that's a testament to how often and how well I've worked with Henry and Steven and the other lead actor in it, Derek. We've never worked on something where we're very diabolical about the script. Mm-hmm. If anything, of the four of us, and we've all worked in many rotations where, like, I've been directing and Henry's been running camera, or Steven has, and, like, we've worked in things where Derek has been directing. It's a very fun, insidious little platform that we all work together. And in all those cases, if anyone has been very strict about script, sometimes it's been me if I have had a fast-moving comedy, mm-hmm, where I'm like, no, 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 the joke is written to sound like that. Even then, I am not, like, very intense about sticking so hard to a script, and none of us really have been. I think that is the style of filmmaking, was, like, as natural as it can sound, and if it's going to sound more natural rephrased, then that's what we want.
Just want to feel
certainly
real.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean there were definitely a lot of lines from the, you know, 5% of that script is you see on the screen. And it's important to have that level of comfort. And, like, we just felt comfortable improvising and experimenting. And I think that shows, like, how relaxed people feel in that film.
Yeah.
I just watched a film, like a Mammoth film from, like, the 90s. It's called State and Maine.
Oh.
Yeah. Incredible cast. It's a Mammoth thing. And you can feel, like, the chokehold that he has on that script and on those actors. And there are so many lines in that film that sound so unnatural coming out. And that's not any criticism towards the actor. Like, I think they really tried to make some of these things feel natural.
Yeah.
Like, a woman who clearly has an English accent who's trying to play American in, like, upstate New York saying y'all. And
I have to watch this.
I know she didn't want to say it that way.
Yeah.
I know she was like, can I not say y'all and ain't? It just doesn't feel natural. I think Mammoth was like, no, you have to say it. I wrote it, so you have to say it. And it kills me when directors are like that.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't look good. It doesn't sound good. You can feel that actor pushing up against the words and feeling unnatural. So, yeah, I have very little sympathy when something doesn't work, and I can feel that the director just didn't let it work. They couldn't release their vision or their script enough to like let it sound natural.
Yeah, I feel like I'm still forming my opinion on this because I've learned working in television and
how much it does have to stick to the script.
No, well, yes and no. It kind of depends. I was just going to say that I was trained as a playwright first, and what you said about comedy and the rhythm of something, like I think comedy is music, and so if it's off. But I do think a lot of that is in your casting, because if you have a really skilled comedic actor who maybe breaks from the words a little bit, but they innately have that rhythm in them, it will still feel good and right. But I know that there are a lot of creatives I admire who don't want their words changed. And I think that there is part of me that understands that. And I do feel that way with like a very stylized thing or a very like you were saying about like the, this is where the button is, this is where the joke is. And like, you need to hit it a certain way. But then when Mammoth was just in the news for saying some horrible things. And so now I'm like, bleh. But I studied Mammoth a lot in college because he was like one of the playwrights, you know, that like everybody revered. And it is really hard to take his dialogue and have it not feel like a play. Mm-hmm. And this brings me to like one of my biggest things is like, I think certain things should be plays and certain things should be movies and certain things should be TV shows. And like stylistically, they can't all be the same. That's why we have different mediums.
Mm-hmm. And some things can walk that line. I'm rewatching Gilmore Girls.
Yes.
So much of that, so much of Maisel feels like a play, but it's done so well. And like it takes the part of plays that make it feel so real.
Mm-hmm.
Like the continuous shots, the like quippy two-person scenes, and it like works.
Yeah, and if you had a less skilled actor playing Lorelai, you would feel that. Mm-hmm. it wouldn't be as successful, I don't think. But that whole cast is so like they feel like people in a small town.
Yeah, and they feel like stage actors almost that make it work, as opposed to, I totally know what you mean when you see a play filmed as a film and you're like, they just filmed the play.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. They didn't make choices. They didn't change the script at all to like work for this.
For the camera.
For the camera. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally. Okay. So indie film, micro budget film, all of this. How do you keep pushing forward? Because you are like, oozing with creativity and you have all these ideas and whatever, but it can be really, really fucking hard. And when you also want to make money at this, how do you keep yourself motivated? Don't you?
Wow, what a question, especially in the state of this industry.
I'm so sorry.
Shrinkage post two strikes, new op-ed every week about how difficult it is to be a creative in this field. Yes, it is a hard question to answer because it changes so often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a very like personal space, like 2023 started like so strong and exciting for me. Like, I was part of a TV writing, you know, I had transitioned out of digital in 2020, and it within the 2 years of COVID, you know, felt like I built a lot of, you know, momentum towards like getting that dream job. And, you know, and we had peak season going to South by Southwest that I was like starring. I felt like I'll always remember this Gina Rodriguez article from years ago where she talks about how she starred in some Sundance film and like thought that was her big break. And then it was like crickets, and it took years later for her to get Jane the Virgin.
Mm.
But I just really empathize with people who are like, this is going to change my life. And then like nothing changes.
Yeah.
And I felt like I started 2023 with that energy and that excitement. And it rode through March through like South by, which was incredible. And then we get to May and we get to the strike and like, I mean, the air went out of everyone's balloon, but it was also,
you'd been really high, so to come down from that.
Yeah, I'd just been like so sure things were going to line up. And honestly, the last year has been very hard, and I've been very down and trying very hard to remain optimistic. And, you know, I think most people are this way, but like it's very hard to stay motivated when you feel like hopeless or it feels very hard. I was just listening to some quotes by Jane Goodall, who, like, not to compare climate change to, like, my career, but I'm going to. She was talking about how you have, like, you have to give hope to inspire change, like, to another generation. And, like, literally she's talking about climate change and the planet, but I'm taking that as, like, an example of how, like, human beings become inert and don't do anything when they feel hopeless, when they feel like there's not a chance. And, like, honestly, for the last, like, 9 months, I have felt that way. Mm-hmm. I have felt very, like, you know, you can try so hard and things don't happen. Or, like, you can be really qualified and really talented, but if you don't know the showrunner, what do you do? You know, like, I have so many amazing, talented, it's not new news. Like, great writers who their managers are like, well, I don't know. Do you know anybody? And they're like, I don't know. Do you know anybody? You're my rep. Like,
like anyone who can get you a job. Yeah, totally.
And that's not against my rep. I love my reps. Someone else said that about their reps. I would never.
No, it's true. But I do want to, like, part of the reason I asked you this question is because you wrote this really beautiful piece in your Substack, which is called Horny for Content. And
I'll plug it later.
Yeah. It's I really like it's
that,
funny.
That was part of me coming back to, like, doing something immediate and something creative.
Yes.
So I was like, I haven't written. I've done a lot of sketch recently. That was also me trying to get back to something, like, immediate. Just to, like, kind of force myself to write a bit during the strike and
not have to be, like, your pilot or a movie or whatever.
Yeah. And it's just like the best thing about BuzzFeed and I think even over film school is that it forced you to do something every week, forced you to do something new and to put it out in the world and then forget about it and move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And I, without that structure, have been really struggling the last few years to, like, make myself do that and experiment more. And the longer you're away from making things, the harder it is. So I have had to do these small things to try to reinvigorate myself and like get back to creating, because the career of, like, you know, film and television is so difficult. You don't always have opportunities.
Do you find, like, after you write something for your Substack or after you've written a sketch that you are, like, the creative juices are flowing and you're like, oh, now I feel the difference.
100%. Yeah. I feel like I've eaten. Like, I feel like I've taken a yoga class or something. Even if it's not the most amazing thing, you know? Like, I'm not finishing these and being like, that was really good. Sometimes I am. Just because I need something. Let me have it.
Yeah.
But
it's good to feel confident and proud of what you just made.
Yeah. But, you know, more often than not, it's just like a kind of whatever sketch. And I'm like, that was good enough. But I did something.
You did something. The hard thing when you are trying to make money at the thing that's also your creative spirit, like, not to be too artsy fartsy about it, but I think we're attracted to this because we have, like, this every human's creative. If you've done the Artist's Way, she tells you that over and over.
I will tell you about the Artist's Way. I love it.
Yeah. And I think that's very true. Every human is creative and we want these outlets. And, I have found myself get into ruts where I'm, like, very goal or product oriented. Like, what is the result oriented? That's the phrase that every human uses. Result oriented. And then I lose steam and I'm like, I don't have any ideas. I don't know. Like, I want to write because I feel like I should be writing, but what do I want to write about? And then it takes me personally. I'm like, I got to go hiking. I got to go do something. But I did pottery this year because I was like, what's so something fun, creative I can do that isn't directly related to my career goals. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you talking about sketch and stuff, where, like, the environments I've been in when I've done improv is you're mixed with people who want to do this for a career and people who just, like, want to try it or get better at public speaking or whatever. And it kind of humanizes everything again, where you're like, okay, we're all just people wanting to, like, connect or tell stories or whatever. And there's something nice about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really nice to get to, like, also just go to a place and be surrounded by, like, people. Like, it's been so long since I was even in a class or, like, theater atmosphere, you know, like
a dirty black box.
Oh my God. These disgusting, grimy, like, stained black boxes. I was like, oh my God, I'm like 22 again. This is amazing. And surrounded by 22-year-olds. So it felt very, very accurate.
I like to ask our guests if they have an industry, like, funny story, horror story, inspirational story. Do you have anything that comes to mind that you feel is very distinct to your career?
We were talking about starting out as an actor. I, like, always forget how ridiculous, like, my first agent, like, experience was. And this was still when, like, the way to find an agent was to like get backstage and like look at the people that were like accepting submissions like that. Or like, remember you could pay somebody for like the agent list.
Yeah. And you would like get the mailing stickers and
Yes. And like you'd print out your headshot. Like that just sounds insane now.
I probably still have like 100 of them in the back of the closet.
Oh, God, they'll be great. Use them as like placemats at a dinner party one day.
My future wedding is just like, these are the centerpiece.
Honestly, not out of character. I love it. But I just remember, like, it just sounds like it was like a cut to from like an episode of 30 Rock.
Yeah.
Like going to this person's office, like the one person that responded. It was like Mario something. I forget even their last name.
Mm-hmm.
They 100% only chose me because I was like Latina and had a very Latina sounding last name. And they brought me in and it was him and this other woman who I cannot remember her name. I wish I remember, but I promise it was one of those like names like Midge or like some like very old sounding
name. I'm picturing Joey's
name.
Agent from Friends.
100%. This woman had people still on her roster who I kid you not, she had represented for like vaudeville. That makes me sound ancient and I'm not.
No, you're not.
So like people that she maybe represented, I don't know, like when they were children and now they're in their like 80s and she was still representing them.
Yeah.
They had like circus acts. They did. So like I go into this office, I'm not even the Latina he wants. Like he didn't say that. I could read the vibe. He wanted like true Mexican soap opera stars that were either very sexy or like had a perfect can act in Spanish accent.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept sending me out on these. And like my Spanish is good, but it does not sound like a Mexican native speaker.
Yeah.
And also that's the Spanish everyone wanted was like very Mexican. Like I was neither things. I was like, I'm Colombian. I grew up in the Midwest. I have an accent. Like,
yeah.
And it was just like such a funny thing to think of like 22-year-old Claudia sitting in that office and him being like, you speak Spanish, right? I can send you out on all these auditions. I'm like, I mean, you can, but the sides you sent me are like fully all in Spanish. And like, I just don't think I'm going to get that role compared to the other people going out for it. He's like, no, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. And then in the next room is this like chain smoking older woman who's like, you do any circus tricks? And I'm like, no. Like, what?
You're like, let me juggle for
what
you.
Am I doing?
Is there something you know now that you wish that you could tell young Claudia, who's starting out in this career?
I think it's more something I think about like at every stage in my career. And I try to tell myself in the moment and it's what I would have told like younger Claudia. And it's what I'm trying to tell me now, which is just like, why are you so fucking scared? Like do the thing, like you have something someone wants, like go do it.
Yeah.
And it's easy at this sort of like what I hope is the middle stage of our careers, you start to get fearful and start to take less chances. Yeah. And I'm really hard on myself about that in my life now. I'm like, why am I like, when I was younger, I was taking more risks and I was like experimenting more and I was, but that's not really true because I was experimenting, but like I was just as terrified. Like I forget that. I really romanticize when I was, you know, in my early 20s trying things. I'm like, man, I really wasn't afraid. And I'm like, no, I was terrified. I had no money. Like it's just like the stakes were like not being able to afford my rent. Like
that's
high and still, you know, still figured out stuff. So like yes, there are like other very big, scary stakes now in terms of not just about supporting myself. It's like, can I support a potential family and like aging parents? And like, those are really big stakes. But it's like, I was also terrified when I was 23. You're going to feel scared at any point in your life. And I'm trying to remember that.
Yeah. I work with people my age and younger and older on the day to day now. And I think that has been throughout my career. And the thing that I am surprised by is like, oh, well, I thought when I was your age, like I would no longer feel anxious or scared or whatever. And it's kind of just remembering that. That doesn't go away. But I do think that it's kind of freeing. It's like,
And it is when you think of it that way. Like, or you hope that the opportunities continue to grow, that potentially you will always be a little nervous and anxious.
Yeah.
And that is not a bad thing, you know, like.
Because you want to rise to the occasion.
Completely. Tomorrow, if I was embarking on my, you know, smaller budget feature film, I would be very anxious, but excited and you know, in 10 years, if I'm doing a Marvel film, mm-hmm. I will be just, you know, I will be like, this, fuck, like, yeah. Who gave me this? I don't know. While at the same time, feeling the same way as I did, like, about a web series.
Right, you know, yeah. 20s. Do it anyway. You know, you want to do it, so you got to do it anyway. Okay, we're going to do a quick little game of rapid fire.
Okay. Ready? Pretend there's a ticking clock.
Oh, my God. Okay. Uh-oh. Okay, favorite coffee shop in L.A.?
Ooh, Kumquat in Highland Park.
Last movie that made you cry?
We just saw Perfect Days together. I can't remember if I cried, though.
I cried.
I felt emotional, but I'm not sure I, like, sobbed in it. The last one that I was, like, literally not okay was Banshees of Inisherin.
Really?
I went into the bathroom and just, like, sobbed after that film. Oh. And because I liked it, mm-hmm. but it was also just, like, heartbreaking and just, like, the level of humanity and, like, loneliness.
And the pony.
Oh, my God. Like, as I was in the bathroom about to text my boyfriend, I'm not okay, a text comes in from him going, are you okay? I was like, I'm not okay.
No.
But I really liked it. Yeah. That I think that's probably the last film that had me like
falling.
Truly not okay.
I know the answer to this, but Letterboxd or Rotten Tomatoes?
Oh, Letterboxd. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
If you could grab a drink with one director, who would it be?
I mean, off the top of my head, I have like such a girl crush on Deborah Kaplan and like follow her on Instagram and like I love her.
Deborah, if you're listening, Claudia wants to grab a drink.
Yes, Deborah has directed Josie and the Pussycats.
Can't
hardly wait. I'm just a big fan of hers.
Iconic. Last but not least, movie character who you wish was your best friend.
There's so many characters I love, but I'm like,
do you want to hang out with them?
Hang out with them. I did recently rewatch Bring It On. I'm like, I think I always wished I was like friends with someone like Missy.
Oh yeah, I love that.
Like Gabrielle Union's character. I love Torrance's mm-hmm. character, but she was just a lot of energy.
Yeah.
But I was like, I don't, but you know, at the same time, you have a lot of energy. I'd say you're a Torrance.
Oh boy.
And that's a good thing. And and I love you. So maybe that's like a judgment on my part. But like,
I think you're kind of a Missy.
I think I'm a Missy.
Yeah.
We're best friends.
We should do a cheerleading squad. That's just us too. It'll be like a singing telegram and we go and we just do cheers for people.
And I'll be a surly psychic dragged there by your optimism, which is often our experience.
Let us know if you want to participate in this business plan. Well, we've reached the end of our hour. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I always love talking to you on or off the air. Do you have anything you want to plug or is there a place that our listeners can follow you and learn more about you?
Yeah. I mean, you can follow me on mostly active on Instagram at Claude Dog with 2 D's, Peak Season, the romantic comedy we filmed in Wyoming that I star in and executive produced.
We'll link that when this comes out. Sure.
Check out my Substack where I kind of, you know, write about media and fixations and mm-hmm. sometimes my own adventures in this tumultuous industry. And that's Horny for Content.
You can follow me at Vika Stubbs or Not Your Daddy's Films at NYD Films on Instagram. Thank you. Bye.
Daddy Dailies is presented by Not Your Daddy's Films, a social impact organization dedicated to educating and empowering women and non-binary creatives in TV and film. If you like what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a positive review. If you want more Daddy episode insights and links to what we talked about, join us on Patreon/NYD Films. Daddy Dailies is produced in partnership with Robert Bailey and edited by Carly.